Good morning, diners and travelers and readers and just about anybody interested in this whole field of drink and travel, but also writing, because we have an extraordinary writer talking to us today, Bea Wilson, whose latest book is The Heart-Shaped Tin. And if that's hard to get your head around, Bea's going to tell us all about it. You're listening to Ann and Peter Haig talk to Bea Wilson about The Heart-Shaped Tin. Bea, welcome. And you already heard my first question. Everybody asks me, what is your book about?
Hello. Well, thank you so much for having me on. It's such a pleasure to talk to you. The book is essentially about the emotional life of kitchen objects told in 35 short stories, starting with my own heart-shaped tin, which I baked my very own wedding cake in several decades ago. And then it dramatically fell to the ground a couple of months after my husband left. And this set me on a quest of thinking about, why do we have such strong feelings about the kitchen objects in our lives?
Interesting. I kept trying to think, I don't know if I have an object, a kitchen object, that would be in that same category. Do you think we do, Rabbit?
I'm not sure. I was just thinking of the place I used to spend my late afternoons, not far from where you would be speaking to us now. It's called the Copper Kettle. It's on Trumpington Street. Probably still, I shouldn't wonder.
I know it very well. Copper Kettle is opposite King's College, isn't it?
Yes. No, I went to Katz.
Right.
Yes.
I had a friend who was at Katz because I studied here as well. And, yeah, we used to go and have coffee at the Copper Kettle. It's been going a long time. My uncle used to go there when he was a student.
Right. Well, we're used to long times from this setting. Anyhow.
That's so nice that you remember it. Anyway, yeah. It's so beautiful. I'm so lucky to live here. Like, several times a week when I'm walking my dog around town, I just think, I'm so lucky. These green spaces, just walking past the colleges, it makes my heart soar if you catch it in a good light. Like, obviously, we're in the middle of grey November now, so it's not always looking at me.
Tell me about that one. Grey November is right. In the U.S. here, we do have different colors of leaves on the trees, and that sort of breaks the grayness. But when the leaves
American
all...
The American fall is beautiful.
Yes, it is. It is. My mother-in-law just absolutely adored it when she came to visit, you know. So Peter's indicating that he has a question. Here you go.
Let me tell you about the need for interpretation. Shortly after I arrived in Cambridge to sit the exams, what did I do? I can't remember now.
I don't remember what you're talking about. What house? I don't even know that. I mean, I was in Cambridge once with Adam, and you tried to show us all the landmarks that you remembered from your college days, and nothing went right. Everything was changed. I remember that.
Things do change. It does feel like a traditional place, but, yeah, life rushes on. In England, I just think we're always getting every town in England you go to, I guess it's a bit the same in the States, it feels so much the same now because we have all these chain stores and Cambridge still looks different because of the colleges, and I think it does have a little bit of a feeling of a village in a way, and the center will never change to me, but that's kind of funny and sad, isn't it, when you go back to a place.
It's so much prettier than Oxford. I'm going to dig on that one.
I agree, I agree. I grew up in Oxford, so I have strong feelings about those places. But, I love Cambridge.
I'm digging, because I have never in my life visited the city of Oxford.
Oh, never. I didn't.
It makes me feel good every day.
Oh dear. Well, now B, this book is fascinating. I have to tell you that I had lunch with a friend who teaches a creative writing course, and I said, you know, this is a book. She has no interest in anything kitchen, no interest in cooking, no interest in food at all. But I said, you would love this book because of the quality of the writing. And I just must say at the outset that your writing is just so fine that there, you read things and then phrases jump out at you that you can't get out of your head, and you just keep rolling them over in your mind, wanting to repeat them. And that's what I found in your book.
Oh, thank you. That's such a beautiful compliment. I can't say how much that means, because, what I aim for in writing is that it should be good enough that you want to read it slowly and even reread it. And the nice thing with this book, it's funny that your friend isn't interested in food. I feel, although it's very much related to food and the objects of the kitchen, and my whole life really is cooking and food and thinking about food, quite a lot of people who I think wouldn't have read my other books because they're more directly about food have found something of themselves in this book, because I think the theme of having a sentimental attachment to objects applies to those of us who cook, but also those of us who just like to eat or simply look at things that maybe remind us of our childhood. And all of that and more, I think, is there to be found in our kitchen cupboards.
Yeah, well, this comes through in the book as I read it. As I said, I can't really find an object that I recall that I have that feeling about, but you make the emotional side of these objects so clear. Explain this organization. I mean, you mentioned it in passing, but how did you organize this chapter by chapter?
It was, of all the books I've written, it was quite tricky to organize because, as I've already mentioned, it's in many short segments, 35 short essays. Some of them were personal. They were memoir. They related to the end of my marriage and moving on and objects that I associated with particular phases in my life at that time. And so those needed to follow a certain narrative arc across the book. There are other chapters which are about my relationship with my mother, and again, those are interspersed across the book, and the sadness of seeing her grappling with dementia. But then others, I realized I needed to somehow find a way to organize it thematically, and it took me a long time to think, what is it that we sort of go and search for in objects? And it seemed to be many different things. And then eventually I thought of these categories of charms. I mean, I feel that many things we treat as quasi-magic charms. My wedding cake tin falls into that category. Then I thought of mementos. I mean, in a sense, all of the objects that carry strong emotions are ones that are linked to strong memories. And it's so interesting you say you don't have one that you have strong feelings about. I wonder whether, if I were there with you, and I wish I could be, whether we might find one that actually does mean more to you than others. Then junk, which we're, all of us in the modern world seem to accumulate too much stuff, but then junk can get reclaimed and become treasure, which is the name of the final section. And then I have tools, symbols, and gifts. And I found the gifts section fascinating to research. I'd never really delved into the anthropology of gift giving before. And as with many aspects of human life, it's a lot more complex than you imagine before you start to think about it deeply.
I loved your description of how complicated it is in Japan. I love that.
Thank you.
I would be stuck in Japan. I would never be able to manipulate all those hurdles of gift giving. Tell our listeners.
I felt that too. Yeah, so I, the more I researched about gift giving in Japan is a whole other thing. There are so many rules attached to it. There are so many festivals that it pertains to. And it's so extreme in some cases that if parents who have children in their early 20s will sometimes have to help them out financially just so that they can keep up with their gift-giving obligations to bosses and other people. But the problem is then people are just stuck with all of these objects in their house that they don't really use or want. So the kind thing to do, really, if you're giving gifts in Japan, is to focus on perishable items. So there'll be beautiful fruits and other things that people might exchange. But one of the funniest stories.
There's one.
I was just going to say.
There was a, I'm trying to remember what it was I discovered was a just way too expensive piece of. What was it? It wasn't a tomato. It wasn't a peach. It was one of these outrageous fruits, I think, that the Japanese found a place in their life for because they could give it as gifts. And it was like just absolutely out of sight expensive. Nobody would spend that for just to eat a piece of fruit.
Exactly. No, I found that when I was in Japan in 2024, you see these extraordinary pieces of fruit kind of packaged as if they were precious jewels wrapped around so that they can't bruise or get damaged in any way. And you're absolutely right, no one would buy it for themselves. But there's that thing with gifts that you're desperately trying to signal something about yourself and something about the recipient. And there was this story of one of the ones in that chapter that I found particularly memorable and kind of half funny and half sad, that there was a man called Mr. Tanabe who had this dislike of gift giving, and he was desperate just to kind of opt out of the whole absurdity of it. But there was this ritual where a bar owner, he'd given some financial advice to them, would send him these gifts, and he wouldn't reciprocate, so he hoped the whole cycle would end. But there was one year where the bar owner sent him some live shrimp. He then refused the shrimp and just said to the delivery person, send it back to the sender. And then it bounced right back to him. So by the time this live shrimp came back to him, it was all dead. It was completely useless. But somehow he couldn't refuse the gift. And although that's extreme, I think many of us can relate to some degree that there are these things in families where you get stuck in these eternal cycles of gift giving where you long to give it up, but you can't be the first person to crack. Otherwise, someone will be very upset or offended, and you may feel ungenerous.
You know, I was delighted to hit on a chapter about a friend of ours, Kate McDermott, with the pies.
I adore Kate McDermott. So she's a friend of yours. Hello? Can you hear me?
We've interviewed her on the show. I was actually good friends with her late, I think it was her third husband. I'm not sure if it was the second or third.
Mm.
Who works
for the
tailor.
She is such a wonderful...
John Rowley is the one that... She's wonderful, isn't she?
She's really wonderful. So I was so happy to include Kate in the book. When I was researching the book and I was looking for examples of other people who had strong feelings about kitchen objects, Kate popped into my head. We have met once in person in Seattle. That's right. Years ago. But I don't know Kate well, but I adore her books about pies. Many people, myself included, though I'm not American, consider her one of the greatest pie bakers in America. And I suddenly thought, I bet that Kate has some really strong feelings about pie equipment. I thought she was going to pick maybe a rolling pin or a pie dish. But when I interviewed her, sure enough, she very much loves her rolling pin and she put immense thought and time into choosing the right one. But the object that she wanted to talk to me about was much more unusual. And it was these tongs that have hands on the end. And they go all the way back to the 1940s. They were a wedding gift to her mother. and I think they were originally meant to be salad servers, but Kate uses them for everything. And it turned out the reason they were so special to her, she had this one memory of once making donuts with her own mother, and they reached into the hot oil with their hands and they lifted them out. And when she first was describing it, I was thinking, oh, this is so happy. Her mother must have been an amazing cook. But actually, no, this was a rare time when they cooked together. And then Kate's father became very ill, and Kate's mother was too busy to cook, and Kate had to do a lot of the cooking herself. And the more she told the story, I realized that, as with many objects in the kitchen, certainly my own, it wasn't so much that the tongs symbolized Kate's happiness. It was that they were a symbol of happiness in a life that was otherwise marked by difficulty, as all of our lives are. But what was so lovely was that it kind of came full circle. And by the end, she was saying she uses these tongs with people who come on her pie making course. And they make this wonderful sound when you clap them together. They're a bit like castanets. And she just smiled so broadly when she was describing this that I just had to get my own, she calls them the happy hands. And finally, I tracked down my own happy hands on eBay. So I have a pair in my own kitchen, and I think of Kate whenever I use them.
Oh, that's great. Tell us some of the other people that you've created stories about, or that you unveiled stories about, and their objects, that maybe things that surprised you, or our readers would, our listeners would be surprised to encounter. Tell us about some of those that are in the book.
Yeah, so one example would be a tomato-shaped salt shaker belonging to someone called Bonnie Slotnick. Bonnie runs a wonderful cookbook store in New York City. It's unlike any other shop I've ever been into. She sells only old vintage cookbooks and vintage kitchenalia. And when I interviewed her, she said she knew straight away what her most precious object was. And it's this small tomato-shaped salt shaker. It looks so much like a tomato that when Bonnie first showed it to me, I thought, she's just holding a tomato in her hand. What does she mean, salt shaker? But a lot of these salt shakers were made, they were called tomato ware. They were made during the Depression. They were made in Japan and then imported en masse into the States. And Bonnie thinks it must have cost almost nothing, maybe 10 cents, and might have come from a shop like Woolworths. But she said it was the most precious object she owned, and that she, if this ceramic salt shaker were ever to break, she said something will end. And the reason was it had such sentimental attachment again to a mother. And I was so moved by this story. Bonnie's mother died quite suddenly when she was 14. And so this salt shaker took on the role almost of a talisman. And it reminded Bonnie so strongly of her mother, partly the obvious reason that her mother used it when she was seasoning food, but also the bright red of it. Bonnie said that her mother always wore red lipstick when she left the house and had dangling earrings. And what I loved about this example, it's deeply sad, as many of the examples are, but also that she was able to take a comfort from the object, because it was as if this object, it wasn't just associated with her mother, it was as if it had become her mother. And I realized that was a common theme, that people who really love certain old kitchen objects, we treat them almost as if they were family members or even pets. We pat them, we stroke them, and we personify them.
Yeah, but do you think there's a difference between kitchen objects and other objects that one has in one's life?
I do. Someone who helped me make sense of that a little bit was someone called Barry Yorgrau, who also lives in New York half the time, though he lives in Istanbul for half the year. And he wrote a brilliant book about hoarding. And he wouldn't like to be described as a hoarder himself, but he's somewhere on that spectrum and struggles to get rid of things he's attached to. But I asked him why kitchen objects were different from other objects. And he pointed out that a kitchen object can just sit on a shelf where it's not doing anything, and you look at it, and the object he described was a mug that he had bought during a particularly happy trip to Mexico with his partner, Anya. And he said, when it's on the shelf, it's just like a dried flower. But then you can take it down off the shelf and use it and pour some hot coffee into it. And he said, like a flower, it blooms again when you use it. So I think the thing about kitchen objects, in contrast to other mementos like a photo frame or a beautiful ornament, is that they can be things that we look at, but also they're given meaning through daily use. And they can take on these additional overtones of meaning, not just through one person using them, but across generations. And I can't think of many other objects in the home that are quite like that. Someone who spoke about that so beautifully was someone who's in one of the very early chapters, an Indian British food writer called Rupa Gulati. And she had inherited her mother and father's precious dinner service, their China dinner service.
Oh, I love that story.
I'm so glad you like this one.
Yeah.
So it's really a story about us saving things for best. I don't know if you have things, Anne, that you save for best in your kitchen.
Yeah.
Are there certain things you always... Yes, exactly. So I think it's... Part of why I love this is straight away, as Rupa was talking to me, I could relate it to things, ways in which my own grandmothers would have behaved around objects. I think it was something that was so common, particularly for older generations. So Rupa's family, who had come from India to Britain, and they were the only Asian family in the village where they lived in Cumbria, part of north of Britain. This act of purchasing the dinner service, it was such a momentous decision. It cost a fortune. I mean, talk about expensive fruit in Japan. Buying a dinner service was something that people, both in the US and UK, used to spend so much money on. And you'd think, you know, which pattern do we go for? Do we go Royal Doulton? Do we go Wedgwood? If you could afford it, you wanted a dinner service. And it was partly a way to signal, what does best look like in my house? Rupa said that her mother would actually lay the table for dinner 2 days before people came round, which I thought was a whole other level of perfectionism.
Yeah.
But the problem was, it was too special to use. So even after her parents died, Rupa couldn't bring herself to use it. And then one day, Rupa's husband was diagnosed with a brain tumor. And one of the ways in which she reacted to this was quite immediately she felt, I need to get mum and dad's china down and I need to use it. And the reason was, she said, it needed to hear more conversation and experience more food. And I thought this was such a lovely way of looking at it, that the plates themselves hadn't really lived enough. They needed to be enjoyed by a whole new generation of people, Rupa's daughters and grandchildren. And I think, to answer your question about why kitchen objects, I think it's just something about being touched and used and given new meaning each new set of people that come into the kitchen.
And now another question arises is what you're relating in your book, is it history or is it a relationship to these objects that's going to go on because of an innate kind of quality of our nature? I noticed that there's a great deal of difference in my children and their relationship to like family pieces. They're not really that interested in it, which, I mean, we always pass things down. They were cherished. Do you understand what I mean? I think it's different. People also don't do that, the wedding shopping list the way they used to, but it's also hanging on to the family memories. Do they? I mean, they're interested in Ancestry.com, but are they interested in keeping the physical objects?
That's such a good question. And I think, I mean, something I heard a lot while I was researching and writing the book was people, including Rupa, expressing sadness that things that had meant so much to them didn't mean as much to their children. And you can just tell from looking in secondhand antique shops, china shops, that there's a mass of it out there. There's a mass of beautiful crystal glasses as well, which would have once been cherished and loved and passed down and cherished again. And I think you're absolutely right that there has been a shift in relationship to objects. And we're living in a world of overconsumption where the new and the shiny is prized over the old and the historic. Sadly, because it's so much more sustainable a way of living to go to a secondhand shop. And even if it doesn't belong to your own grandmother, go and buy someone else's grandmother's plates, because they're probably going to be beautiful and cheaper, likely, than something you're going to find new in a department store. I don't think it's gone away altogether, this idea of buying kitchen objects for weddings and setting off in life, thinking you really need to be on a good footing in the kitchen. But I suspect that the nature of those status objects has changed. I mean, we hear from patterns of sales that dinner services are so much less important than they used to be. Okay. Whereas things like a stand mixer that might cost hundreds of dollars in some beautiful color that might coordinate with your kitchen cupboards, that's become something that I think is very prized by millennials and maybe even Gen Z cooks.
Right. So where are we going then in our relationship with objects? You must have thought about that as you're writing the book.
Sorry, can you repeat the question?
Yeah, I mean, where are we going in terms of our relationship to objects, given that you've probably thought of what you just explained about the changing nature of that relationship? Writing your book, did that occur to you, and what did you decide?
Yeah, I kept thinking a lot about this. I mean, one of the thoughts that there's a chapter on paper coffee cups, of which so many. And
hello,
it's so sad
that
these
I did not understand that.
Yeah, so I just wanted to write a chapter that addressed the fact that so much of our culture is now a throwaway culture, in contrast to the ceramics and the heirlooms of our grandparents' generation. And these paper coffee cups are used by the million worldwide. And
hello? Oh, dear. Hello? Dear, we lost her. Well, and I think we probably are concluding this interview early.
Supreme Court of the United States is in the background.
We were talking, listeners, to be about her book. And I think we kind of got, she's in Cambridge, England, and I think we got Bea Wilson's book is The Heart-Shaped Tin, and I think we got a disconnected in some fashion. Technology, thank you again. But I think you got an image of what she's considering in this book, and it's so beautiful, the book, the sentiments, the concepts behind all these. Her attitude towards objects and her exploration of different people's experiences. You must get the book and read it. And B, I'm sorry we lost you, but everybody should rush out and get your book. And I thank you for taking the time to talk to us. And hello, Cambridge, England. Peter, you miss your old school, do you not?
Yes.
Yes, well, he does. And we get all the publications from Cambridge all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So thank you. Thank you, Bea, and lots of success with your book.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.